With that, I think we're ready to have the marshal begin the calendar.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bratbold, Judge Siegel, Judge Kirk, the Honorable Diane B. Bratbold presiding.
Right, and good morning. This is the Minnesota Court of Appeals, as the marshal indicated. The date is April 29th, 2020, and we have five matters on our calendar today. Two of those are oral, and both will be heard by WebEx. I just want to again verify for the record that we have audio and visual contact with everyone. I see my panel members, Judge Siegel and Judge Kirk, and I assume that you can also see everyone. Is that right?
Yes.
Your Honor, good morning. Peter Nikita's here. I can't see Judge Siegel's picture, but I do see Judge Kirk.
Judge Siegel, can you see everyone?
Yes, I can see everyone.
But Mr. Nikitas, you cannot see Judge Siegel, is that right?
Your Honor, I just saw Judge Siegel a second ago, and I see her in her apparent chambers with headphones on.
Yes, that's
right.
That would be me. Yep.
So we are all appearing remotely from different locations. So that would explain the different venues you see us. Now, is it Mr. Basie, is that right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Am I saying your name correctly?
Yes, Your Honor. Yep, Basie.
All right, Mr. Basie. So you also have audio and visual?
Yes, Your Honor. I can see everybody.
Okay. And perhaps the two of you have already been through this already, Mr. Nikitas and Mr. Basie. If for some reason you lose audio or visual, just please make sure that you call it to the court's attention. Hopefully that would be that we can hear you at least and you would make a comment. But if not, I believe you've got backup information to reach the court. And we should obviously be able to make some observations ourselves. And then I want to make sure that everyone can see that the marshal has prepared to have a timekeeping device. I'm actually having trouble reading the numbers right now. Maybe that's because they haven't started yet. There we go. Now I can see them. Are they visible to the lawyers?
Your Honor, Peter Nikitas here. I don't see the timepiece. Ms. Friesen recommended I have a separate timepiece on my desk, and I'm doing that. I've got a couple timepieces for timers.
All right. Well, right now the timepiece is ticking down only just to show you how it works. So it should be in the same spot that you would have seen the marshal for the case, Ms. Stock. Mr. Basie, are you able to see the timekeeping device?
I am, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, here's what we'll do. We'll go ahead. We obviously will know what the time is. It'll begin when you start your remarks. And we will just keep tabs on each other with regard to the time, and I'll alert you if for some reason it seems that our timekeeping is showing your time is being done. So with that, let me just call the first case, and after I do that, I'll make a couple of additional remarks before we begin with arguments. So the first case this morning scheduled for 9:30 is appeal number A19-1514. This is Oscar Lee Adams, appellant, versus Jody Harpstead, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services, respondent, Shelby Richardson, defendant. And as we've already established, counsel for both parties are present in court today. We look forward to hearing your comments and to having a conversation with you. I urge you to do two things. First of all, before you begin your remarks, please identify yourself for the record, as well as the client you represent. And then please do keep an eye on the time as the minutes tick down. We do look forward to the conversation, but we only have the amount of time we have. So with that, Mr. Nikitas, if you're ready to begin for the appellant, we are ready to listen.
I shall start now, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. Peter Nikitas speaking on behalf of Appellant Oscar Lee Adams in this Data Practices Act appeal. The Minnesota Court of Appeals should reverse and remand the decision of the district court for trial on damages as well as equitable and declaratory relief. Upon completion of the brief facts require reversal and remand from the respondent's brief. First, the commissioner failed to dislodge the material facts Mr. Adams recited and cited. The commissioner admitted that the district court found at least that Mr. Adams created a material dispute of fact as to liability. I'm citing respondent brief page 10. The commissioner, mistakenly and falsely asserted that the record that the commissioner unlawfully disclosed to Hennepin County comprised records in the public domain. That was at Respondent Brief 4, Note 7. The letter that was unlawfully disclosed was a grievance of an internal property dispute from Mr. Adams to the Minnesota Sex Offender Program Hospital Review Board. Document 32, Adams Deposition Exhibit 2, not a public lawsuit pleading. The commissioner declared this document private data herself. I direct your Honor's attention to addendum page 24, the MSOP privacy instruction. Quote, all data on clients, including information in the client record, is considered private or confidential data and may not be released orally or in writing without written consent or as otherwise authorized under state and federal law. This includes records such as property, grievances, etc. Now, the commissioner's rule of evidence 801D1 admission against interest require trial. The commissioner's disregarded her own regulations, puts exemplary damages under the Data Practices Act into play. And I've cited 1301 subdivision 1, 549.20, and the Newhouse case. Now, the commissioner explicitly invited the court to disregard Minnesota Statute 480 alpha .08 subdivision 3D, which is the prohibition on citing non-published opinions as precedent, and invited the court to disregard this court's own precedent, Dynamic Air from 1993 and State against Scheffler from 2019. In addition, the state Supreme Court has made it very clear in the Blahos case from 2004 that unpublished citation of unpublished opinions is reversible error. The district court.
Let me ask you a question about that. I've read the district court's analysis, and you're certainly correct that the district court did turn to cite and discuss an unpublished opinion from this court. My own reading of the district court's opinion was that the court was very careful to say it wasn't precedent, and that instead the district court found it to be persuasive, which I think is consistent with what our case law says a district court judge may do with unpublished opinions from this court. So would you help me understand your point?
Sure. Thank you, Your Honor. The court may not use unpublished decisions when there are published decisions, plain words of statutes, and rules that are contrary to unpublished decisions. The states, in this particular case, the Department of Administration rule at 1205.0200 sub 13 make it very clear that the Commissioner of Human Services is the responsibility authority for all activities within the Department of Human Services, including the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. The erroneous reliance on the Wills case by the district court was to this point on responsible authority and respondeat superior. So the rule is directly contrary to the unpublished decision. Moreover, the state Supreme Court's Burks decision makes it clear that respondeat authority is the rule and guide for the Data Practices Act. So you have a published Supreme Court decision and a rule, and you have the statute, 1302 subs 12 and 16, that are directly on point. So the reliance on the Wills decision is misplaced. I also note that the commissioner relied on unpublished decisions in numerous places, particularly on pages 12, 13, 16, and 20 of its respondent brief, and inviting the Court of Appeals to follow up and rely on those same unpublished decisions is an invitation for reversible error.
So, but, Mr. Nikitas, let's talk about an area where there are published decisions cited that do seem to cause some trouble, or at least they persuaded the district court that your client did not present sufficient evidence of emotional injury to survive summary judgment. So what's your response to the district court's analysis on emotional injury?
Your Honor, the district court erred in its analysis, particularly of the Navarre case. And I'll direct your Honor's attention particularly to pages 10 through 15 of the reply brief. All right. The statute provides a remedy for any damages under the statute. And I cited Merriam-Webster to define any, because the legislature didn't define any, and the Supreme Court, nor a published decision from this court, has defined any in that context at this time. So Merriam-Webster describes it and it defines any as one or some indiscriminately of whatever kind, whatever quantity, or whatever extent. So the word any embraces the entire universe of damages, including nominal damages, including damages that a jury can find. The as to statutory right violation, I directed your Honor's attention to the Hansen case from the state Supreme Court in 2019. And violation of a right occurs when one adversely, immediately, irredeemably, and involuntarily derogates an absolute right, whether there are measurable damages or difficult to quantify damages. And the case of Hansen has a predecessor in the Pearl case from 1984.
Mr. Nikitas, I'm not quite sure I'm following you. I thought that on summary judgment, your argument was that you were claiming emotional damages and had sufficient evidence of emotional damages to take that to the jury. Is that your argument?
Yes, it is your argument. My argument, Your Honor. It's also my argument that the plain words of the statute embrace even nominal damages as a remedy. And the reason for that is that the word any embraces nominal. As to specific
Mr.
items
Nikitas,
of emotional.
Reading Navarre and other precedent, if the damages are too speculative, they don't get to the jury. So, for example, in the Navarre case, damage to reputation, even though the kind of evidence in that case, the breaches of the Data Practices Act, were things published in the newspaper showing this teacher, dealing with her job performance. So what is the evidence that you're relying on in the record, since this is summary judgment, that your client was damaged?
Your Honor, I cite pages principal briefs 26 through 29 to answer your question directly, and I'd like to get back to Navarre in a moment. His damages include increased distrust of staff at pages 50 through 51 of his deposition. He testified to added stress at page 51. He addressed the unlawful dissemination at his treatment groups at page 53 of his deposition. And he had an expressed concern for false threats made in his name at pages 78 through 20 through 79. He brought the issues up to the hospital review board when facility director, Mr. Moser, was present. And we cite that on pages 123 through 126 of his deposition. And his great concern about the unauthorized dissemination also is based upon a personal experience where he was falsely accused of accessing another patient client's accounts, which we cite at pages 93 through 94 of his deposition. He also had emotional distress because he was regarded by the IRS as a possible identity theft victim. That is found at document 184 in the record. And in particular, there was an IRS scam by a MSOP, a patient client named Senti Halder, who preyed upon other MSOP patient clients. And we find that at the reply brief, page 15. And the case that we cite is U.S. against Senti Haugen, 182719 from the Eighth Circuit of 2019. I will also.
How does that relate to what the commissioner might have done on this case?
I didn't hear your question, Judge Kirk.
How does that relate to what the commissioner may have done on this case or not done or to her employees?
First of all, the employees have no business sending a private property dispute off the grounds of MSOP to Hennepin County. The instruction is absolutely clear that all data, including specifically property and grievances,
how does the incident with the other patient who was trying to access or impact others relate to what the commissioner may or may not have done in this case?
Well, I think the question is how does that make a question of damages, Judge Kirk?
And yeah, that's what I'm wondering. How does it?
Well, if Mr. Adams' invoice with his MREC number was disseminated unlawfully to another client, Mr. Olson, that was testified to. And the MREC number is the gateway to accessing monies in a patient client's account. So unauthorized dissemination of that number could lead to a client patient losing money through no actions of his own, through it being taken from him.
In a situation where mail may have been misdelivered and was immediately returned by the person who wasn't supposed to receive it, is similar to a situation where another patient actively sought information about other patients to use for financial gain? I don't get it.
It's not a question of whether the court gets it. It's a question of the jury getting it. The jury gets to decide that under Article 1, Section 4 of the state constitution and 1308, Subdivision 1 of the statute.
But it has to be relevant first.
Well, it is relevant, Your Honor. It was an unauthorized disclosure of his MREC number to a client who, without Mr. Adams' express written consent.
And how is the issue with the other patient who was up to no good relevant to this case?
Because Mr. Adams, like other patient clients, were put on guard because of this scam to any kind of unauthorized dissemination of its information. That's a question for the jury to weigh.
It's not relevant.
I didn't hear you, so, Judge Kirk.
It's not relevant. Why would the jury consider it?
Well, it is relevant when you consider the district court case, the U.S. District Court case Sierot against U.S. Airways, when the plaintiffs brought a Data Practices Act claim over unauthorized disclosure of the Social Security numbers. That survived the motion to dismiss. And so that
unlawful disclosure of a Social Security number is quite different than anything that occurred in this case. And that was made pretty clear in the case you're citing.
Your Honor, on the contrary, the MREC number is the analog to a Social Security number in MSOP, because like a Social Security number, you can gain access to somebody's money and to somebody's confidential medical information, just as you can with an MREC. That's an analogy.
Citing was talking about identity theft, not the things you're talking about here.
This is identity theft. If I had somebody's MREC number unlawfully, I could spend money in his name and make it look legit. That is identity theft, Judge. That was his concern. Your Honor, I see that my time is up at 15 minutes. I'll reserve the rest for rebuttal if we, unless any of the judges have questions right now for an extension.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Nikitas. I think the panel members are likely to be able to save their additional questions for rebuttal. So that would mean we'll turn things over to respondent. And Mr. Basie, when you're ready, you can begin.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Brandon Basie. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the respondent in this matter, the commissioner of the Department of Human Services. Your Honor, the district court correctly granted summary judgment in favor of the commissioner because appellant failed to provide sufficient evidence to corroborate his emotional distress damages, the only damages that are alleged in this case. Despite appellant's efforts to complicate this case, the district court's decision and the facts of this case are actually very straightforward. And I think as the court is aware, the case involves two distinct disclosures, alleged disclosures of private data on the plaintiff in this matter. And in short, Your Honor, with respect to the first disclosure, the one that went to Hennepin County, the district court correctly found that the plaintiff failed to corroborate damages because the documents that were disclosed were of the same type and character of documents that the plaintiff voluntarily made part of the public realm in his lawsuit. I want to
talking, counsel, Mr. Basie, you're talking about the property dispute that was also part of a public lawsuit, or at least some portion of those facts.
Correct, Your Honor. In the Hennepin County, in the alleged disclosure that went to Hennepin County, there was basically what's called a client request form, which is an internal document at MSOP, and then an attachment to that client request form the plaintiff alleges sent to Hennepin County. I wanted to address one thing that the counsel said, and he claimed that the commissioner is falsely stating that what was disclosed was a pleading in the case, and that's just simply not what the commissioner has ever argued in this case. What the commissioner argued is that the documents that were disclosed involved the same type of information, that is this separate lawsuit, the property dispute that the plaintiff was having. He filed a separate lawsuit on his own, and he put in the public record allegations relating this property dispute and a bunch of other documents, including emails, and correspondence, client request forms, receipts, like that. The commissioner admits that the actual client request form that's at issue in this case was never put into the public record in the other case. But what was put in the public record, all the information that surrounded that type of a claim. And so what the district court found in this case is that it's not genuine to say that you're suffering emotional distress damages and concerned about what might happen with data that gets disclosed to one county agency and one person at a county agency, when you yourself put that same type of information into the public realm voluntarily on your own. Your Honor, the second alleged disclosure in this case was a piece of mail that contained the plaintiff's medical records number or MREC number. But the undisputed facts in the case, Your Honor, show that this piece of mail went to one client. The other client had the document in his possession for no more than 2 minutes. That client, the only thing that client saw on his document was Mr. Adams' name. He never saw the MREC number. He never memorized the MREC number. He never told another client the MREC number. He didn't have it in his possession long enough for any other client at MSOP to even see the MREC number. And so what the district court found was that any concern by the plaintiff that he could suffer some kind of adverse consequence from the disclosure was not genuine, because there was really no disclosure of the MREC number in this case.
But did the court decide that on liability or damages? I thought the court was saying there were no damages, not that there wasn't a factual issue as to whether there had been an improper disclosure.
Correct, Your Honor. There isn't a dispute that at least with the piece of mail that the disclosure happened. The commissioner has never disputed that the disclosure happened and the mail was sent. What the court was a damages question that said, and the court found that it's not genuine to claim that you're concerned about financial exploitation when the thing that was turned over, or when the only person who received the MREC number didn't actually see the MREC number. And so even if the fact that the document went to the person it is a violation of the Data Practices Act, the person who got it never actually saw it. And so it's disingenuous to say that the plaintiff suffered some kind of emotional distress for something that can't occur, and that is someone using that number against him. The plaintiff has tried to cite these other unrelated incidents. He cited this incident that happened over a year later of another client trying to access his account. But there is no causal connection between that other client accessing his account and the disclosure in this case. In fact, that other client that's undisputed in the record is not the same person who received Mr. Adams' mail. It happened a year later, and Mr. Adams failed to provide any type of connection between the disclosure and that other client trying to access his account. The discussion about this third MSOP client who is supposedly prosecuted for tax fraud, this, the first time that the plaintiff has ever alleged anything related to this third party is in his reply brief at the Court of Appeals. We've never heard anything about that being a basis for any type of damages at any point in this case up until the point at the Court of Appeals in the reply brief. He cited to an IRS form. That form was not admitted into evidence. The court found that it was not relevant to the issues in this case. The plaintiff relies on it in his appeal, but it was never part of the record. And the plaintiff in this case hasn't appealed that was an abuse of discretion in this appeal. The IRS form is also just simply not relevant because there's no indication that was provided to plaintiff because of the dispute in this case. And that is covered, I think, pretty thoroughly in our briefing, so I won't reiterate that for the court.
So, Mr. Basie, I'd like you to address Mr. Nikitas's argument about nominal damages. I'm struggling to remember when that first got raised, but actually, he's obviously relying on it in his comments to the court today. So what's your response to that?
Yes, Your Honor. I appreciate the question. I appreciate the opportunity to respond to that. The plaintiff has made a lot out of the word any in the statute in 13.08 subdivision 1. And the Minnesota Supreme Court acknowledged in the Navarre decision that damages can be awarded in a Data Practices Act case, but when the only damage that's alleged is emotional distress. The Navarre court specifically says that the emotional distress damages have to be one, severe, and two, they have to be accompanied by circumstances tending to show their genuineness. The Supreme Court did not say that any means nominal damages. In fact, the Supreme Court didn't say any means non-severe emotional distress damages. So what the Supreme Court has said is that any, in this case, for emotional distress damages requires a threshold level of something that's severe and genuine in order to recover under the Data Practices Act. The plaintiff said no authority for his proposition that that there is some kind of nominal damages that's awarded under the Data Practices Act. And if that's the case, if what plaintiff is arguing is correct, that every single violation of the Data Practices Act must go to a jury to determine whether or not there was a violation. And that's not what the statute contemplates. The statute contemplates someone suffering some kind of damage. And if we're looking at the plain language of the statute, Your Honor, the statute specifically says, when it talks about compensation, it says the person who suffers any damage as a result of the violation. And so there just isn't anything contemplated in the published case law from the court, from the Supreme Court, in the unpublished case law from this court that has on multiple occasions upheld both summary judgment grants to the defendant, as well as Rule 12 dismissals for failing to allege sufficient emotional distress damages in complaints. So this idea of nominal damages under the Data Practices Act is just something that's not contemplated by any of the case law the Quinsuck County Commissioner in this case. Your Honor, I think it's important to talk about this point that, appellant has argued at this court and the district court that he's entitled to a jury question on this claim of damages. And as this court is well aware, not every claim goes to a jury. A jury doesn't hear every issue that is in a case. And in this case, there was no disputed material facts. The court applied law to the facts that were undisputed in this case and held that the threshold that the Navarre case has outlined was could not be met by the plaintiff. Your Honor, I just want to touch briefly on the non-monetary relief that was sought in this case, specifically the declaratory judgment request. Your Honor, plaintiff has argued that even if he didn't suffer any damages in this case, that he's entitled to at least a declaratory judgment. And the Declaratory Judgment Act and declaratory judgment just doesn't contemplate this type of relief in this type of a case. What plaintiff is asking for is essentially for the court to hand him Minnesota Section 13 of the Minnesota statutes, which says that private data is private and public data is public. This isn't a type of a case where someone is questioning whether a county board is subject to the MGDPDA case and whether their meeting needs to be public or private, or whether a piece of data, you've requested a piece of data, you're asking whether it's public or private. There's no dispute in this case that if it's found that the commissioner was liable for the production, that the things that were produced were private data. That's not disputed in this case. And so we've cited, Your Honor's, cases, both the Stark case and the auto owners case. The Stark case is a U.S. Minnesota Supreme Court case. The auto owners is a court of appeals unpublished the case. But those cases specifically outline that the Declaratory Judgment Act is not meant to declare facts. And in this case, the plaintiff is just asking for a declaration that a disclosure occurred. And that's just not what the Data Practices Act is meant to do, or the Declaratory Judgment Act is meant to do. Your Honor, with respect to the injunctive relief claim, plaintiff, these are just two separate, distinct alleged disclosures that happened. The plaintiff didn't provide any type of evidence of irremedial or irreparable harm that would necessitate an injunction. He hasn't alleged there's some kind of ongoing thing that's harming him in this case. Anything further that is just speculative at this point. Your Honor, as his claim for mandamus relief, I think he's asking to claw back information. As we mentioned in our brief, there's just simply no information to claw back. Either the information has been returned or destroyed. That's undisputed in the record. In any event, there's no authority under the MGDPA to claw back data. And then as to the punitive and exemplary damages in this case, Your Honor, those were dismissed at the very beginning of this case. The plaintiff never moved to reamend the complaint to bring in more facts to re-put punitive or exemplary damages in the case. That wasn't the denial of that, or the dismissal of those damages weren't appealed in this case. So they're just simply not part of the record. Your Honor, as I stated at the beginning of this case, the commissioner asked this court to affirm the district court's decision granting the motion for summary judgment. As we stated, the two alleged disclosures in this case, Your Honor, involved data that simply just do not present a genuine issue of fact as to whether the plaintiff in this case suffered genuine and severe emotional distress damages, which again are the only damages in this case. For those reasons, Your Honor, the commissioner would respectfully request that the court affirm. And if the court doesn't have any further questions, commissioner will rest.
Thank you, Mr. Mazey. And with that, Mr. Nikitas, we will be ready in just a few seconds for you to begin your 5 minutes of rebuttal if you choose.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ready now?
We are.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll make bullet points and then address it. First of all, the commissioner is false on three material points. Page 2 of the principal brief, Mr. Adams put the issue of the denial of admission of the IRS letters into the record. That's on page 2 of his principal brief on the statement of issues. Point number 2, the papers that were unlawfully disseminated to Hennepin County were not part of a lawsuit. It was a grievance of the MSOP's failure to inventory his personal property when he was moved from one residential area to another. And in the course of the move, there were personal property items missing. That was his grievance, not a previous lawsuit. And most significantly, Your Honor, the commissioner has misstated the holding in the Navarre case. This is a material misstatement of the holding. I direct Your Honor's attention to page 30 of the Navarre case. That's 652 Northwest 2nd, 9, specifically page 30. And the Supreme Court explicitly rejected the high threshold for intentional infliction of emotional distress to apply to the Data Practices Act. I quote you the first full paragraph on page, the last full paragraph on page 30, and it says, here the respondent failed to produce any verifiable medical or psychological evidence to support her claim, but did introduce evidence indicating the appellant's disclosure of information made her extremely upset and caused her to be afraid to go out in public. While this evidence was conclusory and not substantiated by any medical testimony, we affirm the Court of Appeals and hold the evidence was sufficient to allow the respondent's emotional damage claim to be submitted to the jury. The problem that required the Supreme Court to reversal and remand was that the district court excluded countervailing psychological expert testimony to refute the damages. That's why Navarre was reversed and remanded. But the Supreme Court was clear that just on her testimony alone, as well as her father's, that was enough to make a jury question. And I did cite in, Mr. Adams did cite in his brief a related case from the U.S. District Court by Judge Schiltz on the Data Practices Privacy Act. This is the federal statute on unlawful disclosures of driver's license cases. And the language in the Data Practices Act is like the DPPA language and led Judge Schiltz to reject any argument in favor of a heightened standard of emotional distress, that garden variety emotional distress presented a jury question. I also in the brief.
So Mr. Nikitas, I'm going to interrupt you just briefly. I've lost a visual on the timekeeping device. Oh, but now it's back and you can proceed. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Not a problem, Your Honor, not a problem. So we contrast the Data Practices Act with the Privacy Act, the federal law, and the DPPA. The DPPA's clauses are similar to the Data Practices Act. There was no issue of a sovereign immunity. In the Data Practices Act, there's no issue of sovereign immunity because the legislature explicitly voided all immunities under the statute. Now, by contrast, the Privacy Act awards damages only for actual damages, and the Supreme Court in decisions from 04 and 2012 narrowed it even further to pecuniary damages based on the language of the Privacy Act calling for actual damages and the modified relinquishment of sovereign immunity. There is no similar language in the Data Practices Act. It's any damages, and the legislature voided all immunities. So using that and the Navarre case, the threshold for emotional distress damages going to a jury is very, very low. And the plain words of the statute say any damages, that embraces nominal damages by the definition of any, when there is no other definition of any under the statute or a controlling precedent or a rule. I see that's my 5-minute timer. Your Honor, the nominal and emotional distress damages, bring this case to trial before the jury. The court should reverse and remand. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Our thanks to both counsel. The matter is now presented to this court and submitted for a decision. We greatly appreciate your briefing and arguments on the issues presented to the court, and we will issue our decision within the 90-day timeframe. So with that, counsel, thank you very much. That concludes our argument on the first matter on the calendar today. I realize that I believe